This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Rethink 2014.
The American economy.
Climate change without.
Hacking.
Different religions in it.
Sustainability.
Social media.
Security. Freedom.
Technology.
Marriage.
Essentially ethics.
Privacy.
Throughout the month, we've had conversations that provoke new thinking about social mobility, America's role as a global superpower, and the role of fantasy in marital fidelity. Today, an inquiry into the medium that we are sharing at this moment, radio. Since the dawn of the digital age, we've been hearing that the end of radio is nigh. With countless online streaming services and podcasts available on mobile devices and now cars, listeners can create their own playlists and preferences, and radio will go the way of the buggy whip and the printed newspaper. While program directors and sales and development teams have been fretting over how to keep audiences, people like Jesse Thorne have been creating them. Jesse is host and producer of NPR's program Bullseye. He's also the founder of Maximum Fun, a podcasting network that is home to several popular comedy podcasts, including Jordan Jesse Go and Judge John Hodgman, both of which Jesse produces and co-hosts, and the storytelling series Risk. If that's not enough, he also hosts Put This On, a video series and blog about men's style. Jesse, so glad you could make time for us today. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay, Jesse, so does the future of public radio mean that I have to have as many jobs as you have?
Oh, man, you're starting with a real pain point. I mean, I never expected to have this many jobs. I just thought I would get a regular job. When I graduated from college, you know, like I went to a pretty good public university, you know, sort of mid-level public university, and did well and had a nice college radio show and thought I could just get a job at a radio station and do that as my career. And it just didn't work out that way. And it's not working out that way for a lot more people in media these days. And there's sort of a good side and a bad side to that.
You're straddling this world pretty successfully. You have a terrestrial radio show. That means carried on radio stations, you know, that have radio towers. And you also have podcasts, which are available online. I guess a question to start with is, do we need to rethink what radio actually is now that we have mobile devices and connected cars and audio streaming? Am I still listening to radio?
Radio as it is, as it has always been, has some really great advantages. One of them is ubiquity. You know, the average American household has something like, I can't remember, it's like 9 or 11 radios in it. So basically every room in your house has a radio in it somewhere, whether it's an old Walkman or a clock radio or a shower radio or a car radio in your garage. So there are very few places where you can't just press a button and there's the radio. It's coming out of a speaker and you can enjoy it. You know, radio is also locally based and typically locally based and live. And so, you know, it can be responsive in ways that media that doesn't have those qualities can't be. You know, I live here in Los Angeles. And I grew up in San Francisco. If I want to know if I just felt an earthquake, it's actually more convenient for me still in 2014 to go to the radio than it is to go to the internet usually. So there are some advantages to radio, and they extend to the places where we tend to listen to audio the most, like cars. You know, cars all have radios in them, and almost no cars have the ability to stream data.
But that may be true now, right? I mean, a couple of observations here. People under 25 do not own radios or listen to radio as we program it here at NHPR, for example. And cars will have onboard computers soon enough. Right?
Yeah. Well, I would say that young people still do consume a lot of radio. You know, it's less than it was before, but they still do consume a lot of radio. You know, radio isn't any more going to disappear than books are. You know what I mean? It has some built-in conveniences and, you know, it will be a long decline and other media will replace some elements of it, but it's not going to totally disappear. As far as why public radio doesn't, well, it just doesn't program for those people. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have the incentives to program for those people because it's, you know, substantially donor supported and young people don't have the money to make major gifts that sustain public radio stations or institutions. So while the mandate is there to serve all people, the incentives aren't.
Okay, well, there are two different tracks here. One is the survival of the future of public radio, which means that public radio darn well better get young people listening because they want them to listen through their life and support. But let's go down the other track here first. We've been hearing about the predictions of the last days of radio for about 20 years now. So I was surprised to read Pew's State of the News Media 2013. That study showed that 92% of Americans age 12 or older listen to the radio at least weekly. Why then all the doom and gloom about the death of radio being nigh?
Well, I think the truth is that there are other options on the horizon. And it's easy to think that this is a dichotomy, which goes, number one, this is 1973 and FM radio is on the rise and everybody's jamming out to the latest hit from the Doobie Brothers. And we all have a mass culture that's propagated by, you know, Wolfman Jack or whatever. I'm mixing up my time periods a little bit here. I hope you'll forgive me.
We're still with you. You're in the album rock era right now.
Yeah, somehow. Exactly. So it's the peak of radio when you listen to your local morning radio DJ to go line up for concert tickets for 8 hours, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the people think it's that golden age or it's radio is dead, blah, 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 blah. Radio has some great advantages that I think will keep it alive for a long time as things decline slowly. One of them is it's relatively inexpensive to produce radio compared to, say, a newspaper, which requires a team of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. Radio is relatively inexpensive to make. That was one of the reasons I could make a show totally by myself for 6 or 7 years, however long it was that I was doing my show without help. Audio is within one's grasp.
We're speaking with Jesse Thorne, a sort of radio impresario of sorts, both in the terrestrial and the online or podcast universe of radio, about the future of radio. We're rethinking that paradigm, the way that it's always been, that radio has come from some station somewhere and been listened to by the masses. Well, now it's being produced by people and selected by people individually. And that's a question for you, Jesse. You know, right now, everything hinges on self-selection, right? Especially if you're talking about this under 25 cohort. These are people who find things that they want to listen to, podcast them, stream them. How do they find things? How does your podcast, for example, get distinguished from all of those that are out there?
Yeah, I think that's one of the big challenges in the world of the internet. I think what we've seen the last 5 years or so, as social media has become sort of the dominant form of the internet, it's sort of replaced the, you know, the blog role on a personal website in that way, is that quote-unquote viral content becomes dominant, which is to say content that someone wants to tell someone else about. That is not always the best content. Being the best content can help, but generally it is something that inspires emotion, that has a surprise in it. Those are the things that go viral, and that's what's dominant right now. That's a lot harder in the audio space, but you still see its effects. I mean, I think that if you take the example of my friend Mark Maron's show, WTF, which is a very big podcast, you know, hundreds of thousands of listeners, I think Mark's personal story and some of the incidents that happened on his show early on. Mark is a stand-up comic who had sort of hit a brick wall in his career and then decided to do this podcast. And the show is about him sort of working out his issues as he talks to his colleagues and contemporaries and so on. And that story was viral in and of itself. You know, it's something you want to tell someone else about. And that is sort of what spreads these things. It doesn't work as well as it does with, you know, with text or in some cases with short videos. You know, this conversation where we're talking about ideas and in a slightly abstracted manner isn't the kind of thing that goes viral on the internet. If I told you a personal story about how my grandmother died, but I learned an important lesson that helped me bring my child into the world, and it related to this, that is the kind of thing that would go viral on the internet. And to some extent, that's the kind of thing that you're talking about.
All right, so let's get to your grandmother then. Well, I want to go back to the numbers thing here, or the ubiquity, I think, is what you're talking about. You said Mark Maron's podcast, really popular, hundreds of thousands. Okay. For years, Morning Edition and Rush Limbaugh have been switching places as the most listened to radio broadcasts on terrestrial radio. It was only in 2012 that Rush had his first significant dip in ratings. It went down to 14.75 million weekly listeners from 15 million. Other big numbers here. Howard Stern used to serve about 20 million listeners on terrestrial radio. Then he went to satellite radio. Now maybe 1.25 million listen at any given point. So the numbers, very, very different measures of success from somebody doing a podcast, hundreds of thousands, compared to tens of millions of people who are listening to terrestrial radio. Now, I don't want to sound like, you know, a newspaper editor in 1999 or defensive and saying that our numbers are so much better. I want to ask you where you see that heading.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that that will continue to be the case. I mean, the truth is that there are things that lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of people like. They're like the Super Bowl, you know, or American Idol. There are things that are designed for huge audiences. And there are things that are so great that they get huge audiences, you know. But there are things that will always be like that, like the Super Bowl. Those things are immensely valuable. I don't think they're disappearing forever. But in the world of the internet, you have something very different, which is the difference between something that is good enough that someone won't change the channel and something that's so good that someone chooses it. People will go to extraordinary lengths to just continue on whatever path they're on. So picking something is a really significant act. You know, that's why advertisers always want to advertise to 18 to 34-year-olds. It's because once you've decided that you like Crest toothpaste, mm-hmm. you know, you just use Crest toothpaste forever just because it would be a hassle to pick a new toothpaste because what if it wasn't good, you know?
Right.
And so people don't like picking things. So if it's something that someone has picked, it's a much deeper, more powerful relationship. I know that of the tens of thousands of people that listen to one of MaximumFun.org's shows on a podcast, that audience is so much more connected to the programs than the tens of thousands of people who listen to Bullseye on the radio. Mm-hmm. And that's in the context of public radio, where I think listeners are relatively strongly connected to the content they're listening to compared to, you know, 105.4 Hits FM.
Right. Such good programming that people choose it. And in public radio, we count on them to then pay for it directly, which brings us to the financial model, which I think we have to talk about if we're rethinking radio. Right now, I'm looking at the top 10 podcasts on iTunes, very heavy with public radio programs. This American Life, Radio Lab, along with, you know, Dan Patrick and Welcome to Night Vale. People are definitely appreciating and downloading interesting stuff. But for the terrestrial radio station, this is where things get dodgy for us, that your podcast, Roman Mars 99% Invisible, Radio Lab, can invite people to support them directly. The downside is that it is taking money, perhaps, from hardworking radio stations like New Hampshire Public Radio. So is that going to cause tension between those who are program makers and program carriers?
I think the premise that you're asserting causes tension. I don't know if that premise is really 100% correct. I think that people's giving is about what they care about. It's not about what they've given to other things. You know, we live in a very profligate country. You know, people, the United States is very rich. The people who give to things have enough money to give more. Even if you make $35,000 a year and you give $50 to your local public radio station, you still have another $50 to give to something else if you are moved to do so. And local public radio stations provide a service that's different from what a podcast does. A podcast is a really cool thing, but it isn't an always-on source of stuff about where you live, and it's not a curated collection of stuff that's designed for people who live where you live, and it's not a brand that you have known and trusted for decades, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
But what if you're raised getting free content everywhere? You know, there's no if you're used to that model, what is going to make you shell out for anything, connected or not?
Well, if you want to see it, if you want to see it continue to exist. I mean, when I told my dad that I was going to start this thing, my company, as a mostly donor-supported for-profit company, he thought that was the craziest thing in the world. And now I'm sitting in an office with 8 or 9 employees and, you know, really significant revenues, because I think that while there is this feeling everything should be free, I also think that there is a feeling that goes along with that that is underrepresented, which is this feeling of, and I should support things that I like, which is the way of paying for everything should be free. I mean, you in the radio business and me both in the radio business and in the podcasting business are giving everything we do away for free. Anybody in New Hampshire with a radio can listen to New Hampshire Public Radio for free. So the people who are supporting us are the people who think that is a significant thing and want to see it continue. But I generally think that that feeling that young people get everything for free because they're so entitled is wrong. And in fact, young people want to get everything for free. They want to have access to everything, but they also want to support those things so that they can continue to exist. They want to have a relationship with those things. That can include, you know, giving money voluntarily.
Jesse Thorne, is it sunny there in Los Angeles?
It is pretty sunny. I think the high is going to be in the mid-70s today.
Do you think we could all come and work for you?
Yeah, absolutely. By all means. I'm putting up a shingle. I'm hiring the entire state of New Hampshire.
Jesse Thorne, host and producer of NPR's program Bullseye, among other things, also the founder of the podcasting network Maximum Fun. Thank you so much for your time today.
Of course. Thank you so much for thinking of me.
With so many choices, we know that exploring the wild frontier of podcasting can be pretty daunting. But don't fret, we do have a starter package for you. We asked Jesse Thorne to share 6 of his favorite podcasts with us. You'll find that list on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we asked you on Facebook, what are some of your indispensable podcasts? You can find them all at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2012, a program manager at Microsoft named Karen Chang decided to learn how to dance. So she started practicing and filmed her progress every day for 1 year. From those first clumsy frames to her last really impressive display on day 365, Karen collected the footage in a time-lapse video that beautifully illustrates what a difference a year can make. That video has now been viewed more than 3 million times, has landed Karen on a number of primetime TV shows, and become the inspiration for her new project called Give It 100. Karen Chang, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Virginia.
So you say the process of filming yourself dancing every day helped you stick with it and to see your own progress. Why do you think it made such a difference?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. The first one is when you watch yourself back, you see things that you can't necessarily catch in the mirror. And that goes for a lot of things, not just dance, sports, for example, musical instruments. But then the other thing is that you are able to see yourself progress in a way that you wouldn't otherwise. And I think, you know, it's kind of like a child when you're growing. You don't really know that you're growing until, like, your aunt sees you every, like, year or so and says, oh my gosh, you've gotten so big. And it's really the same thing when you're learning. You never notice when you're getting better. But then when you watch your videos from a month or 3 months or a year ago, then that's when you realize, wow, I have really improved.
So that became the seed for Give It 100. How can people participate in that?
So you go to giveit100.com and you choose something that you want to get better at and you agree to practice it for 100 days. And then you just share a video of you practicing it for 10 seconds every day. And you'll post that video and you'll see other people doing the same thing, and you give each other encouragement and it helps you keep going.
And the website does advise new people signing up for Give It 100 not to aim to make the perfect video. Why not?
Well, you could make the perfect video but on day one, but then how much progress would you see on day 100? And so if you show your mistakes, you'll be able to look back on what was the true you. You know, on the internet, on YouTube and on Facebook, there is so much pressure for everyone to kind of bring their best selves mm-hmm. and to kind of show like a perfectly glossy version of your life and put an Instagram filter on like whatever, you know, scenic view you see today. And Give It 100 is really the place for you to share the raw underbelly and your mistakes. And when you're juggling, it failing. And when you're trying to do a handstand, you falling. And we really encourage that because, you know, perfect is boring. I think mistakes are a lot more interesting.
Looking through all of the projects on Give It 100, some that may sound mundane are surprisingly inspirational. I'm thinking of this guy, Jason. He recorded himself trying to touch his toes every day until finally doing it.
Yes.
How does sharing in other people's success help motivate us, do you think, Karen?
Well, I think it's wonderful that, Jason, he's trying to touch his toes. And you see him getting closer, inching closer and closer and closer every day. And for a lot of people, this is a silly challenge. But for many people, they see the video, which now I posted it yesterday, now has 20,000 views, this is like such a simple little thing that I could never do, that I just assumed I couldn't do. But then here's this, like, the most inflexible guy I've ever seen, you know, working at it day after day, and sure enough, on day 40, he can do it. And I think it's just so compelling to see people when they can't do it yet, working hard at it, struggling at it, and eventually getting it. And I think it's just a reminder that, like, everything that we see, every talented person that we see, at some point started a beginner.
Well, there were some projects that really surprised me as well, like trying to find a man. Not hitting the snooze button was another one. Or training my cat to use a human toilet.
Yeah, I'm really excited about the training cat to use a human toilet. And I can't wait to see that cat like using a human toilet on day, you know, 50 or whatever.
Any other great surprises for you seeing the creative ways people are using the Give It 100 platform?
I think the biggest surprise has been the community that's developed because, you know, when we had the idea for Give It 100, it was literally me looking at my dance practice footage thinking, oh, you know, it would be a more easy way to look at all those footage if it was organized like this. And so I wasn't thinking at all about the community aspect of it. But what we see happening is, you know, you log on every day and you share a video of you trying your best and probably making a bunch of mistakes along the way. And you see other people every single day struggling and working towards something. And there's really a sense of there's a bond that forms when everyone is pretty much working towards the same thing, which is bettering themselves. And I think the surprising thing for me is just sometimes the overwhelming, like, positive emotion that I feel from going on the website, and I just feel so uplifted. And, you know, I wasn't expecting that, but I guess it makes sense now thinking about it.
Karen Chang, I want to thank you for inspiring us and for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Karen Chang, founder of Give It 100. You can find them at giveit100.com. It's a startup aimed at helping people try things by recording and sharing their progress for others. And there is more about Give It 100 and Karen Chang at wordofmouthradio.org.
She took me to the south with a rolling in her mouth, a cabin made of wood.
We're listening to the song The Night Replaced the Day by the band Spirit Family Reunion.
She was just no good. Oh, she was just no good.
The five-piece band hails from Brooklyn and has come a long way since their days busking at farmers markets. Spirit Family Reunion spent 2013 touring the country in a van in support of their debut album, No Separation. The album got lots of critical praise and attention and propelled the band to the stage of the Newport Folk Festival and to record a tiny desk concert at NPR's headquarters. Now Spirit Family Reunion is kicking off 2014 with an East Coast tour and will be playing at the Press Room in Portsmouth on Friday, January 31st. Producer Zach Nugent spoke with lead singer and guitarist Nick Pankin and asked him how a band from the big city came about playing such old-time American music.
Growing up in New York City, you know, we sort of get exposed to and listen to all different kinds of music, but there's definitely a healthy dose of, you know, Pete Seeger growing up, Woody Guthrie music, and if you go to summer camp in New York State, I don't think you can escape Pete Seeger. So it's kind of like when you get that into your ears when you're a little kid, and then when you go, you know, later on in life, when you hear the banjo again, it feels so familiar, and it feels like something from your childhood. And it doesn't require too much thought or planning. It's just kind of like, you know, it's just kind of from the bone.
Listening to one of your more popular songs here, Green Rocky Road, and it's a tune that's been around for a while. Can you tell me about it?
Well, when we started playing Green Rocky Road, we just kind of were listening to this record by Karen Dalton of the same name. It has a bunch of songs that are just home recordings of her playing banjo, and she's just got a really cool sort of unique style.
When I go to Baltimore, need no carpet on my floor. Get your coat and follow me, I know man in Galilee.
So we learned a bunch of songs off of that record, and that's where Green Rocky Road originally came from to us, and then it just sort of morphed into this thing that it's become.
One of my favorite tracks on the album is No Separation. What can you tell me about that song, and why did you choose it as the name of your album?
No Separation is a super-duper simple song. It's three simple verses and one extremely simple chorus. It just feels like an honest song, and it could be played any style, like the Carter Family, or it could be played, you know, super fast, like an old-time sort of song, or, you know, the way we played it is kind of heavy and slow.
I don't want no separation. I don't keep no bad company. I don't need no
It's a fun song to sing, and I guess it's, you know, it's part of about being all together, our band, you know, it's a bunch of folks playing music together, and, you know, we want to get to know each other, and we want to get to know the audience, and we don't want the separation between the crowd and the stage, we don't want, you know, I mean, I'm so glad I have these people to play music with still after, you know, five or whatever years.
I don't keep no bad company.
that was Nick Pankin, singer and guitarist of Spirit Family Reunion, speaking with Word of Mouth's Zach Nugent. To hear more from the band, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. The telling of the scary story is as old as the campfire. Now they've made the jump from summer camp and slumber parties to the web. The internet's hunger for new, shareable content has sped up production of scary stories and urban legends. A bewildering number of web forums, message boards, and specialty websites are dedicated to sharing stories that have been passed around so often that nobody really knows where they came from, and which maybe, possibly, could be true. The genre is called creepypasta, a seemingly silly name for some of the scariest stuff on the web. And our guest, Will Wiles, wrote about creepypasta, what he calls a sort of folk literature of the web. We read his article in Eon magazine. Will Wiles, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello.
We have to get this out of the way. Where did this name creepypasta come from?
Well, it derives from a more general term, copypasta, which just comes from the words copy and paste, meaning any short piece of text or image that is copied and pasted around web forums and shared widely without necessarily being attributed to an author or a point of origin.
Where are some of the places that you can find creepypasta online?
Well, there are dedicated sites like the Creepypasta Wiki and creepypasta.com. They're also shared on more general forums such as Reddit and 4chan. But, Google will pull up anything. Tumblr has got creepypasta sites as well.
The more a story gets shared, the more shrouded in mystery it becomes. What's that playing into for us as humans who love these kind of stories?
Well, scary stories serve a useful social purpose. They let us know which fears we have are commonly held, and we know that other people share our fears, which is, inherently reassuring, even if the telling of the story is very scary. As you mentioned, the campfire is a social experience, not a private one. So, there's always been great value to fright. Retrospectively, it stands to reason that this would be ported into the internet age.
This has become quite a phenomenon with sites like Creepypasta, extremely popular. The site does receive thousands of scary stories whenever there is a call for submissions. So who's doing the calling and who's doing the writing here?
Well, the marvelous thing about it is that it's all enthusiasts. It seems to be genuinely grassroots effort. It could be anyone. You get a real sense of there being very few barriers to entry, to submission.
But what does that mean for the quality of the stories?
Well, like anything on the internet, it varies extremely widely. And the majority are pretty poor. There's a particular kind of very famous story or even a genre of stories because creepypasta invites imitation. But anyway, one of these popular stories is called Jeff the Killer, which seems to me to be rather unoriginal and violent. And yet it's extremely popular, so there must be something to it.
What's the story?
But it's about a psychopathic child being spared the attentions of a killer and then becoming a killer, I believe.
There are a number of subgenres within the creepypasta world, apparently. You found a number of urban legends. Maybe give us a little overview or synopsis of some of them. And why the urban legend works so well on creepypasta?
Well, I mean, the reason I discovered creepypasta was I was looking into urban legends. I was trying to find the origin of a particular urban legend. And I discovered that essentially creepypasta was a way of sort of mass-producing urban legends. It was as if the desire for urban legends on the internet, the readership for them, had exhausted the available supply. And they were having to be kind of mass-produced. People were, deliberately creating them and then sharing them. There's a lot of haunted software stories along the lines of Branded Laptop. There's a lot of quite basic sort of hack-and-slash killer stories along the lines of Jeff the Killer. There are some quite clever twist stories, there's one called Portraits, where a man is in the woods at night and is forced to take shelter in a cabin. And the walls of the cabin are lined with horrible portraits of these semi-human creatures, their faces twisted into rage. And nevertheless, he gets some sleep, and the next morning he wakes up and discovers that there aren't any pictures on the wall, just windows.
Dun, dun, dun.
That's a kind of, slightly Twilight Zone-y kind of twist at the end.
Will Wiles is with us. He generally writes about architecture and design and is the author of one published novel, one upcoming. But in this case, we're talking with him about creepypasta. This is the internet phenomenon of sharing really, really scary, apocryphal stories, sort of, as he says, like what we look at as folk literature today, passed around on the World Wide Web. Another story that you featured in your article is called Bad Dreams. Tell us about that one. It's really scary.
Well, Bad Dreams is an excellent example of creepypasta because it's pretty effective as a scary story, but also it's extremely short. It begins...
Daddy, I had a bad dream.
You blink your eyes and pull up on your elbows. Your clock glows red in the darkness. It's 3:23.
Oh, sorry, honey. It's going to be okay. Do you want to come up on the bed and tell me about your bad dream?
No, Daddy.
The oddness of the situation wakes you up more fully. You can barely make out your daughter's pale form in the darkness of your room.
Why not, sweetie?
Because in my dream, when I told you about the dream, the thing wearing Mommy's skin sat up.
For a moment, you feel paralyzed. You can't take your eyes off your daughter. The covers behind you begin to shift.
That is a creepy story.
That's all, which is really quite. I mean, as a sort of like literary, as a sort of literary effort, that's really effective. You know, I mean, writing a short story, I mean, a very short story, requires a lot of skill. It's really excellent.
You point out that this is a leaderless, authorless movement. What do you think is the motivation then to write these stories if one is not getting any acknowledgement?
Well, there is acknowledgement. I mean, on the sites dedicated to creepypasta and so on, people are sharing stories, talking about each other's stories. You know, there's you know, food for the ego there. What's just interesting there is if they're successful, they're shared, and in sharing, often their origin is lost. And so the measure of success is to become kind of forgotten as the author, if you see what I mean.
Is scary different in the digital age than it was before?
Well, the props are certainly different. I mean, you know, these stories are often bang up to date in terms of their technology. You know, they're to do with Wi-Fi, they're to do with laptops, they're to do with social networks, you know, Google Maps. But often their concerns are perennial, to do with fears of possession, fears of ancestral evil, that kind of thing, which could come out of, you know, the ghost stories of the 19th century or the gothic novels of the 18th century or folklore or myth. So in many ways, these stories give absolutely up-to-the-minute form to ancient fears.
Well, Will Wiles, thank you for the primer on creepypasta.
My pleasure.
Will Wiles wrote about the crowdsourced horror story website Creepypasta for Aeon Magazine. He's also the author of two novels, one, The Care of Wooden Floors, and The Way In, which is out later this year. For more information on his books and to read his creepypasta article, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In some musical circles, there is an unspoken commandment when it comes to live concerts. The louder, the better.
You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly.
Unfortunately for Nigel Tufnell of Spinal Tap, turning your amp up to 11 does not, by definition, make music sound much better, clearer, or even more rock and roll. In fact, a lifetime of overly loud music can leave fans and musicians forced to listen to something nobody wants to hear.
One of the most common forms of tinnitus is called ringing tinnitus, and it is just a tone, something like this.
About 50 million Americans suffer from tinnitus, or ringing in the ears. Among them, Neil Young, Eric Clapton, Metallica's drummer Lars Ulrich, and Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas. Despite the risks, many musicians and fans do not protect themselves by wearing earplugs or turning down the volume in their earbuds and headsets. Molly Boschman is a concert photographer and a contributor to Pitchfork, where she wrote about tinnitus and the cultural bias against wearing earplugs. Molly, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
How loud is too loud for our ears to handle?
There's sort of a threshold of 85 decibels that most audiologists agree is a threshold after which long-term exposure, which means anything more than a half hour as a general rule, is dangerous. What happens is tinnitus is actually a neurological problem that originates in the brain, and it involves the miscommunication between noise-damaged sensory cells in our brain. So when our ears get jostled by very, very loud volumes of noise, like an explosion or noise coming from a rock concert, there's a failure of those noise transmitters to properly communicate impulses to the auditory nerve in the brain, which is a long, convoluted way of saying you shake it too much, it'll never stop ringing. And small venues where sound is trapped and sort of recirculated and reverberating against these hard materials like the concrete of a warehouse or the concrete of a basement where you might be attending a small show, will trap and reverberate sound such that even if it is played at 85 decibels, which the average rock concert is not, it's more like 110 decibels, the volume can sort of get ratcheted up with sort of an echo effect.
Well, that puts people, musicians and people who work in the live music industry, as well as, you know, I'm guessing people who operate jackhammers or something, at the highest risk of ear damage. But as you point out, people in the audience don't always protect themselves, and musicians don't always either. Is there a stigma against wearing earplugs in some professional music circles?
I definitely think, depending on the genre, you see this more. For example, a lot of punk music and metal music, as well as the historic loud rock and roll, any sort of genre of music that has a certain visceral nature where the experience is supposed to be very cathartic because it's, you know, so loud and uninhibited and explosive. Those genres, I do think there is a sort of unspoken stigma about wearing earplugs. You know, it's sort of like the equivalent of, you know, plugging your nose over a chef's food would be to wear earplugs in a concert setting where by nature you may be expected to experience some sort of not quite direct like physical pain, but a sort of shock. You know, in those cases, I definitely think there is a conscious decision not to wear earplugs, even if you might end up with some ringing in your ears, because maybe people associate it with a job well done on the part of the musician.
And I guess there's also the sort of, you know, there's the devil may care attitude, or I don't want to grow old anyway, so who cares if my ears are ringing? Well, there are lots of debates also as to whether the earplug actually diminishes the concert experience. Objectively speaking, would you rather go see a band play at a safe volume, or would you rather wear earplugs and have them play really loud?
I would love for musicians and for venues to play music at safe levels to begin with. But since for a confluence of factors, that's not necessarily possible today, there hasn't been a big dialogue about why music is played this loud. And I think there's a miscommunication between the audience and people who work in the venues and musicians who aren't necessarily always aware of how loud they are because speakers are facing away from them. That kind of leads to this. There's not really a public dialogue going on about this issue. And as a result, I don't think many venues are going to be playing music at safe volumes anytime soon. And as a result, I would definitely encourage anyone who loves music and experiences it in the live setting to consider wearing earplugs, which most audiologists agree. You won't lose a significant amount of sound or anything vital to the mix by wearing earplugs. You can only protect yourself.
All right, we've talked a lot about live shows, Molly. How about wearing earbuds? Is there a maximum level that we should be turning up our earbuds to?
It's interesting. When you read the information on the earbuds that come with, say, an iPod, the literature actually suggests that, you know, listening to concentrated streams of music at very high volumes can be dangerous. But conveniently, they don't quite tell us how loud that is. Is that with the volume all the way up at 11, for example, like in the Spinal Tap clip that we heard? Or is that anything above the midway point? I would say, you know, there's never such thing as too much music as long as you're listening to it at a safe level. So, you know, if you're going to blast your iPod for that moment on the subway just to cancel out a short-lived conversation that you don't want to hear, that's probably okay. But if you're walking around 24 hours plugged in, playing and listening to music at a maximum volume, perhaps you should reconsider your daily activities.
All right, Molly Boscherman, who, as we heard, only occasionally turns it up to 11, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Molly Boscherman is a concert photographer and a contributor to Pitchfork. You can find a link to read her article, How Loud is Too Loud? It's at wordofmouthradio.org. It's not uncommon to hear loud music blaring from a construction site or a record store or maybe in an artist's loft. But how about the operating room? As it turns out, even surgeons like to whistle while they work, or in some cases, bang their heads. Word of Mouth's Taylor Quimby spoke to a couple of New Hampshire doctors to find out what is on their surgical playlist.
So I'll make this quick because I'm sure you're busy.
Okay.
Can you tell me your name and what you do?
Hi, I'm Dr. Quimby, and I'm a urologic surgeon at the Cheshire Medical Center in Keene, New Hampshire.
And you're my dad.
And I'm your dad.
Right. When you go into the operating room, do you have a choice of music? Like, how do you listen to music, or do you even get to listen to music?
So most of the time we do listen to music. We have essentially a kind of an iPod docking station.
What do you like to listen to? Say, you know, everything's going well, you're grooving along, you're jamming, you're doing your thing.
I would listen to some U2. You know, one of the things that I really remember was back in residency when I was a surgical intern, we used to play U2 during our closing, you know, Street with No Name, because it was just has that, you know, upbeat music to just get you to finish up and sew up a patient's abdomen.
I wanna reach out and touch the flame where the streets have no name.
I happen to know that you listen to the Dark Knight soundtrack by
Absolutely.
Hans Zimmer a lot. Do you ever put that in the operating room?
Yes, I have put that in there. I've listened to that in the operating room. It's really actually great classical music.
My name is Paul Bettinger, and my specialty is hand surgery. I don't know if you remember the station K-Rock.
Mm-hmm.
So they've nicknamed me the Doc of Rock. I like to play heavy metal in the OR. I've been listening to heavy metal since I was a teenager, and I've been kind of playing heavy metal in the operating room ever since I've been in the operating room. And so now what I do is I kind of tailor the music to the level of anesthesia for the patient. So if they have general anesthesia, then the heavy stuff comes on.
Right.
And if they have kind of a regional anesthesia where they're kind of awake, then I put the lighter rock on.
What are your favorite bands or things to play?
Yeah, so for the heavy metal stuff, I like to play Korn and Metallica, Godsmack, Five Finger Death Punch. Today I played Avenged Sevenfold.
That's like really hard stuff.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's heavy stuff. We're going for the hard stuff.
How do your nurses or, you know, the people that work with you, does everybody...
Yeah, they're all on board with it. They've gotten used to it over the years, and I've converted some people over to the dark side.
Have you ever been hated or discriminated against? I have. I've been protested.
There were times where I'd play some rap, and, you know, if I was playing like Eminem and he's really starting to go off,
yeah,
people would get a little upset. But most of the heavy metal stuff, they can't even understand the words, so they don't really, you know, they don't have the opportunity to be bothered by the words. They don't really understand it. You know?
It must be great for you compared to, say, being a dentist, where you're pretty much obligated to play really bad music.
Right, exactly.
While people are in the chair.
Yeah, that's why I didn't go into dentistry. I couldn't take the music.
The Doc of Rock, Paul Bettinger there, an orthopedic surgeon at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Hospital in Keene, speaking with producer Taylor Quimby. We'd like to discover other workplaces where music is part of the job. Let us know what you play and where by leaving a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are so many great ideas being passed around word of mouth. We'll be back with more next week on NHPR and online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio,
follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth,
and check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.